Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, Chris Evans here with a special edition of the Best of the Breakfast Show podcast with Sky from Virgin Radio. Today with neuroscientist Professor Russell Foster, author of Lifetime, the new science of the body clock and how it can revolutionise your sleep and your health. One of the most useful books I've ever read, and I've read them all. Here we go.
If there's anything a brekkie show needs, it's a super smart neuroscientist with several salient sleeping suggestions. Thankfully, there's one here in this room. His book, Lifetime, the new science of the body clock and how it can revolutionise your sleep and health, is out this Thursday. With the circadian rhythm of the night, it's Russell Foster.
Good morning, Russell.
Good morning, Chris.
So the wise late night owl meets the barking mad early birds. How's this going to go, I wonder?
Indeed, yeah. I'm okay. As I've got older,
yes.
Of course, I've got more of a morning type, but as a student, I was really quite a late type.
Right, so the new science of the body clock and how it can revolutionise your sleep and health. How come it's a relatively new science, considering it's been around for as long as we have?
Well, it's a good point. I mean, what's happened over the past 20 years, the Nobel Prize, of course, was given in 2017 for understanding the molecular mechanisms that generate this 24-hour oscillation, this internal clock within. And it is incredible. I mean, it's the best example we have of how genes encoding their protein products, those proteins interact, and then generate a 24-hour oscillation. But in parallel with this extraordinary science, you've got the realisation that these clocks are impacting upon every aspect of our life, whether it's our ability to generate a sleep-wake cycle, our memory consolidation, our processing of information, our metabolism, you name it, those clocks are involved. And that's been the revolution. It's the realization we've got to embrace this biology and use it to enhance our sleep and our health.
And ignore all this at your peril and embrace it at your fortune.
Yeah, absolutely.
Why don't we do it more?
I think there has been a tradition of marginalising sleep. Sleep is for wimps. It's an indulgence. It's a luxury. And it may go back to sort of the old Protestant work ethic, because work is virtuous. And of course, when you're asleep, you can't work, and therefore sleep, by definition, is not virtuous.
Yeah.
And I think there's that sort of baggage. And it's sort of... it's the way that we've structured our industrial society. And in a sense, many elements of the workforce have been bludgeoned into submission.
Yeah, and it's really not good for us. And we continue to sort of swim against our natural tide. Like mealtimes, for example. Speak to mealtimes, please, if you don't mind.
Well, it's fascinating because, we tend to have our main meal at the end of the day. And that's, again, a part of the way we've structured our lives. You know, the commute home, the end of the day, that's when we eat. But in fact, in the pre-industrial era, it was breakfast and lunchtime. In the medieval era, that's when all the feasts were. They were at our lunchtime. And that's really important to appreciate, because our ability to process food and glucose, for example, is much more efficient during the first half of the day, during the second. Some really interesting experiments had individuals on calorie restriction. And one group had it their calories in the morning to lunchtime, and the other group lunchtime to evening. And the lunchtime to evening lost far less weight than those on the morning side. So it impacts, you know, upon our ability to process
glucose.
And
we've allowed it to be pushed later, and then you couple it with the slowing of metabolism and calories in the afternoon literally count double to calories in the morning. We've had somebody else talking on about that, and that is a thing. That is a true thing. And then you sort of compound that with the kind of foods we're eating and the addictive qualities of those foods, or not qualities, what things that take away from our well-being, salt, oil and sugar, of course, being the three main villains in that particular scenario, and our decision tree becoming less and less easy to resist because we fall to temptation the more tired we get.
Yep.
And you have this recipe for disaster, which is happening on a daily basis, and we seem to be doing nothing about it.
Yeah.
What can we do about it individually and also as a race?
I think we've got to get this educational message out. I mean, I think a really clear example of this is in night shift work. If you look at night shift workers, they're at higher risk of obesity, diabetes 2, metabolic problems, you know, generally. What do we provide in terms of food opportunities for our night shift workers? It's high fat, it's high sugar. Now, why nobody has actually developed a protein-rich, easy-to-digest food for the canteen to enhance, you know, individuals' health on the night shift work? It's just crazy. It just hasn't been done.
But there's a market out there. And, yeah, you know, we are seeing the green shoots of more wellness and well-being. You know, again, in the interest of you know, big food, because they have to make it profitable, and that will drive, if they can make money out of it, that will drive change. And if we stop buying the rubbish stuff, they will have to change, yeah, which is good.
Yeah.
That's all great. What about different times to exercise to do with our circadian rhythms?
Well, that's a little bit complicated. So we have this, yeah, we have this sort of different metabolic state. So during the daytime, we're taking in calories and we're burning them.
Yep.
But at nighttime, of course, we're relying on stored calories, which we then mobilise and then burn. And so there's two options here. If you exercise before breakfast, mm-hmm, you're still on nighttime metabolism. So you're burning stored fat. You're burning stored calories.
Right.
However, our ability to exercise improves throughout the day to the late afternoon, early evening. So exercising at that time means you'll have greater power, a greater ability to exercise. So you have an option. If you're a morning person and you're comfortable with this, then you could have your exercise bout before breakfast, or somebody like me, you'd have your exercise bout in the late afternoon and early evening, and that's when I can actually do more exercise more efficiently and burn more calories. So many people, for example, have a dual thing. They have a 10 or 20 minute pre-breakfast and then a 30-40 minute you know, on their elliptical or whatever later on in the day.
So Cristiano Ronaldo, famously one of the fittest people in the world, he's eking out his footballing career much longer than other people in the past have. He doesn't exercise that much. What he does is he exercises often. So, and this is part of his exercise for sport, he moves for 15 to 20 minutes every hour, yeah, for 12 hours during the day. That's how he exercises to remain fit. And if you go and stay at his house, he will invite you to move with him for 15 minutes every hour.
That's interesting.
How does that sit with you?
No, that's great. I mean, you know, essentially you're moving around, you're burning calories. I mean, one group where movement is really important is in the elderly, and so one of the great problems that the elderly face is the need to get up in the middle of the night and pee. And what happens if you're sitting all day in a chair watching telly or at a desk is that fluid accumulates in the lower legs.
Right.
When you lie flat, that liquid, that fluid, is then reabsorbed. And in fact, just by lying down, if you've been sitting all day, you can generate a litre of urine. The bladder is about 350 mils. So, you know, before you lie down and go to bed, get that fluid reintegrated within your system.
You talk about the bottle, don't you? You talk about the bottle in the book, the bottle of pee in the book.
Well, yeah, I mean, yes, that's right. It's good for the garden.
It is good for the garden. But gardening generally, you know, the longest living areas in the world, the blue zones, which I'm sure you're aware of, you know, it is all about gardening. It is all about constant movement, isn't,
yeah,
it? It is all about rarely sitting down,
yeah,
and making that a thing. And, you know, we often say, oh, my mum would say, oh, let's take the weight off our feet. Take the weight off your feet. Come in, sit down, take the weight off your feet. But you sort of don't want to take the weight off your feet, really, do you?
No, it's tricky. I mean, in fact, you know, writing the book, I would sit there, you know, and grind out the page after page, and Lizzie, my wife, would come in and say, you know, about time you got up and walked around and said, oh, yeah, good point. And we'd have a little walk around the garden together. Oh. Yes, because it was all done during lockdown.
Yeah, and also you do feel, you know, especially when you're writing, because your brain uses so many calories, you do feel like you've been exercising, but you haven't.
Yeah.
And it's the same with thing when you go on a long drive. You know, you finish, if I go on a, you know, car tour or something around some various islands somewhere for a 3-day car tour, you know, with an event, you get to your destination and you're starving hungry. But that's not... It's not the equation that you think may be taking place there.
That's right. Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
What about What about the best time to have sex? Because you do talk about it.
Well, it depends what you want to do with that sex. If you want to have fun, mm-hmm. or if you want to produce children. Mm-hmm. And so it's quite interesting. There's in males, there's a morning rise in testosterone.
Right.
And in fact, in healthy young males, levels of testosterone can be 50% or more higher at that time of day. And in fact, sperm is more active and fitter first thing in the morning. So that would be perhaps a good time. But the key thing to understand is that ovulation, you know, the production of this egg that can be potentially fertilised, is all being gated by a circadian system. And, you know, there's a whole chain of timed events to produce this beautifully timed ovulation. And sperm must be in the fallopian tubes about 2 days before ovulation. And so that's the best time to conceive and have a child. Now, what's also turned out to be really interesting is that night shift workers, night shift nurses, for example, or airline stewardesses, whose circadian rhythms are disrupted, they have much more irregular periods, sometimes no periods at all, very difficult to actually conceive, and there's a significant increase of miscarriage. So it's a good example of where our circadian rhythms are actually impacting directly on our reproductive health.
And long-haul flight crew and night shift workers, yeah. you know, often, like nurses who work their socks off, yeah. you know, can suffer with weight gain, despite the fact that they're moving so much, because of ghrelin and leptin and things. Speak about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's what's so interesting. You know, the hunger hormone ghrelin is released when we're tired. Yeah. And in fact, there were some studies on healthy young males and show that I think with 4 or 5 hours only of sleep each night, their ghrelin levels went up something like 28%. Their leptin levels, the satiation hormone, went down by 17%. And their carbohydrate consumption after a week went up by 35 to 40%. So tired people are predisposed to crave more and eat more, particularly of carbs.
Yeah, which is so unfair. And again, they fall into the fast food thing because, yep. you know, it's the middle of the night and they're eating the wrong thing and they get no nutritional value whatsoever, and then they get addicted to salt, oil and sugar, and it's a massive downward. People need help. They really do need help.
Well, the thing is, we haven't armed individuals with that knowledge.
It's not fair.
And that was, again, the point of the book, which is hopefully people can take this information on board. And it's not preachy or shouty. One of the things that I've got frustrated about is this sort of the sergeant majors of sleep. You must get 8 hours. You mustn't use a Kindle before you go to bed.
Yep.
All that stuff. Actually, this is the unpacking the science behind all that stuff, and people can then make informed decisions for themselves. And that's the key thing for me.
Simon raises a great point. It's almost like he's read your book and he just wants you to talk about it. Simon in Peterborough, I've got a question for Russell. Is blue light as harmful for sleep as people say it is?
Yeah, well, no.
No, it's not.
And in fact, you know, we're the group that discovered these new receptors, these blue light sensitive receptors in the eye.
And I mean, this is massive news. The fact you're saying that is now a modern-day myth.
Yes. So let me just give you the data.
Yeah.
So there was a study that looked at Kindle use. So these individuals were asked to look at a Kindle for 4 hours.
Yeah.
Immediately before bedtime on 5 consecutive nights. And at the end of that, you know, huge insult with a Kindle, if you think about it, sleep was delayed by just statistically 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And as one of my colleagues said at a meeting, well, it's statistically significant, but biologically meaningless.
Yeah.
And so I think that the thing about devices, it's not the light. It's the alerting effect it will have on the brain. And I think we've got to get that right. Because I'm speaking to some teenagers, and they said, oh, yeah, I know all about that. I've got this, my computer, it goes from blue to orange, so I'm not going to be affected. And I said, OK, well, what time are you actually getting to sleep? And he said, well, about 2 a.m. So they think it's, you know, a blue to orange will protect them. And of course, it's having no effect whatsoever.
It's adrenaline, it's excitement, it's creativity.
I think part of the reason why those screen shifts have been so popular is that they're easier on the eye.
Yeah.
But the data supporting that they shift the clock is not really there.
And this is all drawn from the vertebrae of our circadian rhythm for you listening now. Lifetime, the new science of the body clock and how it can revolutionise your sleep and health. It's all about the sense of that, our inner radar, you know, our inner sort of sundial, if you like, literally sometimes an inner sundial. Isn't it?
Yeah.
Of what we should be listening to and why, and how come we're not? You know, how come we're not? Is it because we have been? It's like boiling the frog, isn't it? You just turn up the heat gently, and he doesn't know he's being boiled. And before he can realise it, it's too late, and he's a goner. Is that what's been happening to us as a society? Do you think?
Yeah, I think we. I mean, we tried. We did some studies a few years ago before lockdown to look at the sleep wake of teenagers. And we found that about 20-25% of teenagers have a level of insomnia that could be sort of thought about as clinical. And then we developed some teaching tools for teachers to teach to their students, and we worked very closely with the teachers, and we showed that actually that 25% of kids who were showing insomnia actually improved their sleep wake just with education alone. And we've been trying then to get that embedded within the school curriculum. Mm-hmm. And we hit wall after wall, and I just don't understand it, because this is low-hanging fruit. And so, yeah.
Which usually isn't great, but this is gold. Yeah. It's low-hanging, gold and delicious.
And, you know, by arming our young people with this knowledge, yeah, it's not only helping them now, their educational performance, their mood, and indeed it's been shown that, you know, if you actually can improve the sleep of youngsters, you reduce self-harm, you reduce truantism. But it's information they can carry with them throughout the rest of their life. Right. And so I think you know, the key thing is to embed that information early on. But also in the commercial sector. I mean, the divorce rate for some groups of night shift workers is 6 times higher than the day shift. Now, what we need to do is get the information out there to alert people that this is a potential, not just them, but also their partners. You know, the fact that this person that you married and that you loved hasn't turned into a monster. This is the consequence of massively disrupted and reduced sleep.
But what hope is there for us, Russell? And I'm a very optimistic human being, right? What hope is there for us with these other changes if we are still paying deference to British summertime?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's got to go. And in fact, I'm sitting on a panel which is deciding whether Australia should move off the summertime
schedule.
The US
has just announced it, haven't
they?
Yeah,
indeed. I think Australia will go the same way. We have a slight problem in that, of course, we've got sort of a long geographic range. And so I think people in Scotland are very supportive of that extra hour of light in the evening. But the data show that after this transition, there's a blip in the accident rate. There's a blip in the in heart attacks.
Fatal blips.
Yeah, yeah. And so I would argue against the summertime shifts, absolutely.
And where are we with our circadian rhythm? Is it 90 minutes in general, the sort of cycles within the general cycle of the day?
So the sleep-wake cycle, yeah. So if we can divide sleep up into REM and non-REM sleep.
Right.
And so what happens is that you descend very rapidly into non-REM sleep, right, then ramp up into REM sleep, which is where we have most of our vivid and complicated dreams. And we go through that REM, non-REM cycle every, depends upon how old you are, but sort of 90 minutes or so.
Even 60, during the day as well?
No, just at, right, during sleep. So we don't show those sorts of cycles during the wake state.
So what is the thing that I've read about in the past and heard about and talked about a lot of us feeling sort of uncomfortable every 90 minutes-ish, and it's when you get that itch to go and go outside and have a cigarette or make a cup of tea or lose concentration? Because Einstein famously, every 90 minutes, he would just fall asleep and he would hold a pen. You know this story. He would hold a pencil in his hand in his office, and he had a wooden floor. And every 90 minutes, he would begin to sense the fact he was losing focus. And so then he would just lean back, close his eyes, and just at the point where the sleep was going to be too deep for his own good, he would drop his pencil, it would hit the floor, and that sound would wake him up. Yeah. And that was about a 90-minute to two-hour rhythm. Yeah. What's that about?
I mean, there's no obvious biological basis for that I'm aware of.
Okay.
But I think it emphasises the fact that there's lots of ways of getting the sleep that you need to function optimally.
Right.
And the key thing is you define what works for you and then you defend those behaviours.
Define and defend?
Define and defend.
Oh, I like that. That's great. As long as it doesn't involve too much confirmation bias, because that's unhealthy. Okay, so, I suppose we're sort of erring towards the realms of napping now. So let's just have a chat about napping.
So, again, the general rule is that a 20-minute nap can be quite useful in improving your ability to function during the second half of the day. Longer than that, you can descend into deeper sleep, and then sort of waking from that can leave you sort of foggy. So 20 minutes is the ideal. However, you've got to be careful about naps. And again, we return to our wonderful teenagers, because what's happening is they have shortened sleep at night for a whole variety of reasons. They're biologically programmed to go to bed later. They are also using their devices, which is sort of keeping them up, social media. So the alarm clock drags them out of bed. They're chronically tired. They struggle through the school day, sometimes falling asleep actually at their desks, get home, and then they have a 2-hour or even longer sleep. And what that does is push back the sleep pressure that night, making it less likely they'll get to sleep. And so you can fall into a cycle of extended naps during the day, reduced sleep at night. And that's not, broadly speaking, healthy.
All right. And you can set your alarm clock, you can set your smartphone to wake you up at a certain time, yeah, but you must set your circadian rhythm as well. That's really important.
I think that's so crucial. We've got this beautiful time structure, you know, really. I mean, the thing about our biology, we've got to deliver the right stuff to the right place, the right concentration at the right time of day. And it's our circadian rhythms that sort of give us that time structure. But they're no use unless the internal day is set to the external world. And for that, it's primarily light exposure. In fact, that's where I've sort of done most of our research, which is how does the eye detect this light-dark cycle and set the clock? And in the process of asking what was a very straightforward question, we discovered a new light sensor within the eye. So the eye is this extraordinary organ. It gives us both our sense of space because of vision, but also our sense of time because of its ability to regulate the internal clock.
Yeah, so what I do in the morning, because we're in between shift works, I suppose, because we get up at silly o'clock on a regular basis, yeah, you know, which is an interesting existence. I mean, it's lovely, but you've got to, you can't resist it. And you do for the first few years of doing a job like this, but then you accept it, you embrace it, and then your life becomes better for it. And so what I do in the morning when I wake up at 4, it's like all the lights in my bedroom on, and at 7 o'clock at night, I've got my iPad on, I mask on, and I'm just trying to create, and it does help.
It absolutely does. And because light doesn't have the same effect at dawn and dusk. So morning light advances the clock, yeah, makes you get up earlier. Yeah. Dusk light delays the clock, makes you get up later. And so what you're doing is you're advancing your clock by that morning light exposure, which is great for you because you need to get in to here.
You do touch... The book's brilliant. It's brilliant. We've all absolutely loved your book.
Thank you so much.
And it's such an easy read, which is quite strange because, you know... You tell it very well, you distill it for us, but it's still, there's still a lot of detail in there, but somehow it's still in there, and you make me feel a bit cleverer because you've done a lot of the heavy lifting for us, but you've given us a chance to shine ourselves within the pages of your book, Lifetime, the New Science of How the Body Clock Works and How It Can Revolutionise Your Sleep and Health. And sex before bed can help you sleep.
Yeah, well, that's the data.
I was like, what? So you might want to give this a go, you insomnia, you crazy love-struck insomniacs out there. How does that work?
Well, I mean, it's associated with the release of a bunch of hormones that actually relax you. I mean, one of the great enemies of sleep is stress.
Right.
And anything that can reduce stress is great for sleep.
Okay. We've got a minute left. Is there anything else that we've missed out on, or a headline message you'd like to get across? Or what?
I think the key thing for me is to really emphasise that sleep is like shoe size. One size does not fit all, and what you need to do is work out what works for you and then embrace it. And also, the sleep apps, for example, drive me crazy.
Yeah.
You know, they give you this information. You've had a good night's sleep or a bad night. They simply can't assess it.
Yeah.
None of these apps are endorsed by the sleep societies or the federations. And so take the data you get from those with a pinch of salt.
Yeah, I mean, you know, anybody who wants to put a number on anything usually wants to do that more for their benefit than the well-being or the good fortune of everybody else. It's just a thing, you know, because it's all based on breath and heartbeats, and you don't know. You can still have different breathing patterns and different heart rates and still have a great night's sleep.
I mean, what they're good for, of course, is in the same way that if you want to lose weight, you know, you change your behaviour, you weigh yourself in the morning and you see you've lost weight, and that reinforces the change of behaviour.
Yeah.
So if you look at when you went to sleep, how long you've slept, that's fine, and that can be really useful.
All right. Well, you're more than really useful. Well done, my friend.
Thank you so much.
You're a very clever man. what were you like as a child?
Oh, I was... I was in remedial school for a long time.
But in traditional education, it doesn't mean you weren't a genius. Yeah. It just means that you were...
I just lived in my own world.
Yeah, yeah. It's not learning difficulties, it's learning differences.
I think that's right, yeah. And what we've got to do is provide the broadest educational opportunities for our young people, yeah, and capitalise on their brilliance.
Right, we're way over. I'm in trouble. Thanks very much, Russell. You're awesome. The book, once again, Lifetime, The New Science of the Body Clock. It's amazing, and how it can revolutionise your sleep. Now, thank you, Rachel. Thank you, Vassar. See you all tomorrow. Bye-bye.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky.
Virgin Radio.
All right, that's it for now. Thank you for listening. That was the amazing Professor Russell Foster. If you like this podcast, please rate and review. And if you didn't, don't tell anyone that it even exists. And why not listen back to some other podcasts from my friends such as Russell Brand, Yoann Hari, and even Ron Howard. All right, goodbye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.